Discovering Atlas by Angel Baby One, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Part 1. From the very beginning, James Kirk had the illogical habit of not matching Spock's expectations. A cadet of his academic standing had no reason to draw negative attention to himself for the sake of something so trivial as beating a simulation. Beyond that, he refused to be properly chastised for the event, responding to Spock's allegations of misconduct with anger and self-righteousness rather than the remorse that would have cleared his name within minutes. Yet he did not lash out when Spock mentioned his father, did not lose that odd blend of furious calm that let him stand before the Admiralty without admitting any degree of culpability. It was, Kirk protested, the program itself that prompted his response. When Vulcan sent out its distress call, Kirk should have relented. He should have either admitted his fault and requested flight clearance, or resigned himself to waiting for the fleet's return. Instead, he coerced his friend into sneaking him aboard the Enterprise. When he was caught, Spock expected him to yield to Captain Pike's command, since Pike was one of the few authority figures with whom the cadet seemed to share a positive rapport. Instead, Kirk stood his ground, turning the whole situation on its head, and continuing to do so for the remainder of the mission. He leapt off drilling platforms when logic dictated he stay put. He fought security officers when he should have submitted, but submitted to physical abuse to the point of strangulation when he should have fought. When the situation was his in control, he accepted with ease the input of those around him, despite a long and well-documented Starfleet history of willfully standing alone. He was a dichotomy unto himself, a walking contradiction that seemed governed by a set of rules so convoluted that even Dr. McCoy was often blindsided by them. Spock could not have been more amazed when his older alternate self proclaimed Jim Kirk to be the truest friend of his lifetime. Kirk was one infuriating contradiction after another, and they were to be friends? Such an eventuality was almost inconceivable. It positively boggled the mind. So now Spock was in the unfortunate position of being inappropriately fascinated by the enigma that called itself James T. Kirk. There had to be some sort of explanation for why the cadet behaved the way he did, some rationale for his reactions. With enough study, Spock might even be able to devise a manner of predicting Kirk's insanity before it drove the galaxy further into chaos. True, Kirk's methods had saved Earth and probably the majority of the Federation, but similar anomalies occurred every day. Spock was hesitant to believe Kirk's next display of rule-breaking would end quite so favorably. Luck, as humans called it, could only carry a man so far. Before Spock got the chance to establish his research method for covert James Kirk observation, the Vulcan's next mission arrived. It was a surprise, since most of Starfleet had standing orders to keep close to Earth until the survivors of the senior cadet class could be graduated and put to work filling the staggering gap left by Nero. There weren't enough of them, not by half. But they were strong and determined. Starfleet hadn't seen a similarly dedicated class in many a year. Spock's unusual mission had to be important. His orders came by private courier rather than the usual comm, and the details were absent. Instead, his presence was requested in Admiral Barnett's office at Spock's earliest convenience. Curious. Spock abandoned his early lunch, going immediately to Admiral Barnett's office. The Admiral's assistant indicated that he was currently speaking with a cadet, but Spock would be announced regardless. Spock inclined his head a fraction of a degree in acknowledgement, crossing the hallway to stand before the Admiral's door and wait. A large satchel bag, filled to capacity, rested heavily against the wall on the other side of the doorway. Spock eyed it thoughtfully, but refrained from mentioning it to the Admiral's assistant. When Spock decided to wait by the door for his appointment, it had not been his intention to eavesdrop. However, the cadet inside rendered Spock's intentions irrelevant when he said quite clearly, "Sir." My scores in advanced programming and database construction are unparalleled since the inception of the Academy, to say nothing of my performance in the tactics curriculum. Furthermore, I can provide reference letters from the entire computer languages and programming division, including the chairs, that support my ability to not only redesign but improve. The cadet fell silent, presumably interrupted by the admiral for either his tone or the announcement of Spock's arrival, perhaps both. "Commander Spock," Admiral Barnett called as the door signaled its status change from meeting in progress to proceed, "just in time." Spock stepped inside with both hands locked behind his back. A brief visual sweep of the office revealed the admiral seated at his desk, a slightly exasperated expression on his face as he weathered the undivided attention of, "Ah, I believe you know Cadet Kirk." The admiral's mouth quirked in recognition of the ironic understatement as he indicated Kirk, impeccably dressed in Academy red, with a weary flicker of one hand. "Indeed, Admiral," Spock agreed mildly. "Am I interrupting?" "He's been here for an hour already," Barnett said with resigned irritation. "I'd say our appointment's about over." Kirk, who had been peering at Spock with open curiosity, snapped his attention back to Barnett, his expression going hard and determined in a microsecond. "Sir, I..." "Listen," Barnett said, pointing one stern finger at the cadet. "You're not telling me anything I don't know already. And with the recent death of 20% of the teaching staff of this academy, I've got a lot on my to-do list lately. Let's save ourselves the time here." The cadet took an unconscious step forward, hands curling into frustrated fists at his sides. "But, sir..." Barnett held up a hand. "Don't jump to conclusions, cadet. Not everyone in authority is out to get you." Kirk's expression closed, his posture shifting back to regulation parade rest. Barnett sighed, rubbing his forehead. "All right, Kirk," he said, lifting his eyes to the brilliant blue of one of the Academy's brightest and most troublesome students. "You can have your little project." Kirk's eyes widened in shock, his hands falling slack as his shoulders tensed. "But," the admiral added firmly, "if you spread yourself too thin and collapse again like you did last week..." "No, sir," Kirk interrupted immediately, shooting Spock a sidelong glance. "That was, medical, sir. I kind of escaped from the recovery unit. But I'm better now, and it won't happen again." "Just see that it doesn't. That doctor friend of yours is a menace." Kirk grinned. "Yes, sir, he is. I'll tell him you said so." "Very well." Barnett eyed Kirk suspiciously, as though he knew he'd been hoodwinked, but wasn't quite sure how yet. "Dismissed, cadet. Get back to your classes." "Sir!" Kirk snapped a smart salute, tossing first the admiral and then a bemused Spock his best grin before striding away with undisguised enthusiasm. He slung the abandoned satchel in the hallway over one shoulder, digging out a pad that he began typing on furiously before the door even closed behind him. "That kid," Barnett sighed, rubbing his forehead again. Spock glanced briefly at the office door. "Forgive me for asking, Admiral, but has Cadet Kirk been behaving in a manner unbecoming since his release from the recovery unit?" Barnett frowned at the phrasing. "What exactly do you mean by that, Commander Spock?" The Vulcan arched an eyebrow. "I meant to inquire after the cadet's behavior since his recent trauma, Admiral." The Admiral's unexpectedly defensive expression turned thoughtful as he studied Spock. "Why the interest? Most of the Admiralty doesn't think you and Kirk can even stand each other." Spock's face and posture were without any hint of emotion when he replied, "It was a simple query, sir. I admit to no interest in Cadet Kirk beyond that which I extend to all surviving members of the senior class." "No," Barnett mused, still thoughtful, "I don't suppose you would." "Well," he brushed a hand through the air as though to dismiss the topic, "to answer your question, his actions since his return have been well above what even the Academy might consider becoming." After a slight hesitation, Spock clarified, "Then it is not his behavior that has caused you frustration." "I'm not frustrated," Barnett agreed, shuffling the papers on his desk before returning each item to its previous location. I'm exasperated. How that boy can even think about taking on additional projects with his current workload. The Admiral cut himself off, shaking his head. When he looked back at Spock, his eyes were dark with a delicate mix of admiration and concern. You are aware, of course, of how desperate the situation at the Academy is. The loss of both instructors and student aides has rendered several sections incapable of maintaining daily functions, Spock agreed readily. Officers throughout the fleet had been assigned to temporary teaching positions for which they were woefully unprepared, as they waited for the students who would round out their complements. No one so far was pleased by the results of this solution, and a new one would have to be devised before infighting broke out between resentful Starfleet officers and frustrated Academy cadets. Then you also know that we began asking the cadets to volunteer for extra duty within any and all of their specializations beyond their usual course requirements. Spock inclined his head. The science division was filled with the clumsy, if determined, efforts of cadets who had the arduous task of absorbing the responsibilities of the seasoned officers who would never be returning to their stations. Barnett shrugged a little helplessly. When Kirk signed up for the volunteer program, he gave a blanket request to be used by every and any division that needed him. I believe his exact phrasing was, "Use me like a cheap whore, sir." Then he submitted a list of his abilities and aptitudes that have not been previously known to the Academy, and damned if he hasn't lived up to every one of his claims. So here was James Kirk, again behaving in a manner that was quite outside the parameters Spock had set for him. The Vulcan turned this new angle over in his mind for a quiet moment, trying to understand how the puzzle looked with the addition of an unexpected piece. "Does Starfleet intend to make use of Cadet Kirk as requested?" he wondered aloud. "Spock." Barnett laid both hands palm up on his desk in an expression of exasperation. "You probably don't know this, since your interest in him is admittedly limited, but he was in the top 3% of his class before the mess with Nero, and now he's taking it seriously." The Admiral gave a disbelieving sort of a laugh, incredulous and admiring and vexed. "In order to maintain a normal grading curve, Kirk's instructors have to exempt his scores. Of course we're going to use him, Commander Spock. We wouldn't know what to do with him otherwise." Fascinating. "Anyway," Barnett took out a pad, examining it a moment before passing it to Spock. "Let's try to focus on why you are here. This is your new mission." Spock accepted the pad, flipping through the information for a cursory examination. What he read caused both eyebrows to lift in interest. "We've located 3 planets so far that might work for a new Vulcan colony," the Admiral explained, leaning against his desk. "A team is going to survey them for habitability. It isn't a long-term mission. We aren't projecting anything more than a few months. We want to send the team out tomorrow, but civilians can't be cleared that quickly. So if there's going to be a Vulcan on the mission, it has to be you." "Mission accepted, Admiral," Spock said immediately, looking up from the pad's data. "I shall procure the necessary equipment and be prepared by 0700 tomorrow." He hesitated, glancing back at the pad before adding, "Also, I wish to extend my gratitude that Starfleet would permit me to leave the area with our forces so diminished." Barnett smiled, his expression warm and understanding to a degree that Spock couldn't look at for more than a moment. "Who better than a Vulcan to pick the best place for Vulcans?" "Indeed," Spock agreed. "Well then," Barnett nodded, "dismiss Commander Spock." Filled with the challenges and problems presented by the opportunity to aid in the selection of a new Vulcan homeworld, Spock's mind tucked the lingering question of Cadet Kirk into a small box and put it aside. But not for long. "We're going to give Jim Kirk the Enterprise." For a moment, Spock thought his hearing must have become faulty during the last 3 months in space. He shook his head to clear it, a nearly imperceptible motion, and said, "Pardon?" Barnett looked up from Spock's mission report, a grin in his eyes, even if it wasn't reflected in the calm of his face. At his graduation ceremony a week from Friday, the Admiralty intends to uphold Cadet James Kirk's field promotion and give him the flagship Enterprise. She'll be ready for a shakedown mission by then, which is as good a way to start as any. Vulcans didn't gape, which was the only reason Spock managed to maintain his well-honed, expressionless demeanor. "Sir, if I may make a query..." Now Barnett did grin, sitting back in his chair with his elbows propped on the arms. "By all means, Commander Spock. We drew straws to decide who got to break the news to you. I've been looking forward to fielding your response for weeks." "Sir," Spock began, ignoring the odd non sequitur about straw and fields. "While I can appreciate the need Starfleet must have for qualified captains, it is highly illogical to base a promotion as unprecedented as this upon one successful mission that was, in itself, unprecedented." The Admiral's expression then was odd, amused, and compassionate by turns, as though Spock were the victim of a cosmic joke that Barnett himself had suffered through on a previous occasion. He seemed to relate to Spock's befuddled confusion every bit as sincerely as he derived hilarity from it. "I know you just got back," he said eventually, "but let me make a suggestion. Find Jim Kirk and follow him around for a while. We can draw up an excuse if you need one, but I really don't think you will. Kirk hasn't been notified of where he'll be serving after his graduation, much less in what capacity. If you still think we're wrong about this promotion, after walking his path for a few days, we'll take your concerns into account." Spock struggled with the idea of Captain James T. Kirk for a heartbeat before releasing the turmoil as illogical. Barnett saw his fleeting concern and offered him a small, understanding smile. "We were badly wounded when you left," he said softly, lacing his fingers together so he could observe the tangle they made. "Nero took our cadets, and in so doing effectively gutted the fleet. We had to heal quickly, and in any way we could, before the hurt became a weakness." "Understandable," Spock agreed. "However, giving a cadet his own flagship might highlight our current difficulties more than alleviate them." "Situations like ours become something of a baptism by fire for everyone involved," Barnett continued, nodding once in acknowledgement of Spock's assessment, but ignoring it otherwise. "You get to stress people, test their limits, see what they're really made of. Sometimes people just can't stand up under it. We've lost some good recruits recently." "But sometimes," he murmured, meeting Spock's dark eyes with firm conviction, "you find a man who takes everything you throw at him and more, and doesn't give up so much as dig down. Jim Kirk dug his heels deep on this one, and he hasn't let anyone around him surrender so much as an inch to the losses that should have crippled us. We need him and his ilk badly, Commander Spock." "Using that logic," Spock replied smoothly, "his ilk, as you call them, should be similarly rewarded. What of the others who served with him on the Enterprise? Will each be given his or her own ship in the fleet?" Barnett laughed, which was strangely annoying. "Not quite," he admitted, digging through one of the drawers on his desk. He produced a small pile of hard copy assignment requests that he passed to Spock with a grin. Each request ticked Spock's eyebrow a notch higher. "This is the entire surviving crew of the Enterprise as it existed during the final stages of the Nero mission." The Admiral nodded, looking rather like a small boy given his first interactive 3D puzzle. "Each and every one, from every department, cadet, and otherwise, with the notable exceptions of you and Kirk." Spock looked up, eyebrows nearly hidden in his fringe. "They all requested to be posted to the Enterprise?" Barnett shook his head. "Read a little more carefully. All of them, save Mr. Scott, requested to serve either with or under Kirk, wherever he was posted, in whatever capacity they could. Even Chekov, who is in demand by pretty much everyone, just wants the opportunity to work with Kirk again." "And Mr. Scott?" Spock hazarded after a moment's contemplation, sifting through the stack for the relevant form. He requested to serve on the Enterprise specifically, Barnett admitted, but the rumor mill says Kirk made him promise to look after her, which is the only reason he differs from the others. What has Kirk requested? The Vulcan asked, unable to locate the exasperating cadet's form. When we asked him, Barnett explained, shaking his head in amazement again, he said that his previous blanket statement stood. He requested to work wherever he was most needed. Everyone knows he wants to captain the Enterprise again, the Admiral added. Wants it like he wants to take his next breath. But he didn't ask for it. Which is actually one of the reasons we're giving it to him. Toward the end of this week, we're sending a courier with Kirk's orders and a camera. The look on his face should be pretty unique when he reads that letter. This was not going at all the way Spock had expected his debriefing would. We have located an appropriate planet, Admiral. Good. There is one slight issue. We'll fix it. Thank you, sir. You're dismissed, Commander. Take a few days off. Instead, his mission statement was barely a side note, and James Kirk was being given the Enterprise. James Kirk, with his own flagship. Spock thought an appropriate human response to a situation such as this one might be, "What the hell?" Barnett laughed again, but it had the strangest note of hysteria tickling its last note. "Believe me," the Admiral said fervently, leaning forward to stress his point, "I know how crazy this sounds, how unbelievable and illogical. You haven't even been gone 3 months, after all. Your confusion is both understandable and expected. That's why we drew straws to tell you. But, Spock, the data you're using to draw your conclusions about this is 3 months old, and I can't tell you in coherent words how much has changed in just 3 months." "Yes, sir," Spock acknowledged blandly. He set the request forms back on Barnett's desk and locked his hands at the small of his back. The Admiral sat back with a slightly defeated air. He rested his elbows on the chair's arms once more, twisting one wrist to check his watch. "It's nearly 9, he observed. "Go find Kirk and watch him for a while. Bring yourself up to speed. Let us know your findings." He drummed the fingers of his right hand on the pad Spock had given him. "In the meantime, I'll go over your mission report with the rest of the Admiralty and determine the best course of action for the difficulties your people are likely to face." "Yes, sir." Though he looked as though he wished to sigh again, Barnett only nodded. "Good. Dismissed, Commander." Spock left without another word, striding thoughtlessly from the building. Sunlight washed over him, completely unimpeded by clouds or other obstructions, causing his pace to slow as he subconsciously tilted his face up to absorb more of its warmth. So, James Kirk, captain of the Enterprise again. At least this time he would be able to accept the title properly instead of simply taking it. But that was anger again, and no small amount of frustration, steering his thoughts from logic. Spock took a deep breath, locking his hands behind his back. He measured his steps carefully, setting them on the path to the only garden at the Academy dedicated to desert flora. It was quiet there and secluded, a good place for thought. He selected a bench in the furthest corner, settling himself with another deep breath. So, James Kirk, considered by the Admiralty to be competent enough for captaincy, was ready for the Enterprise. But then it wasn't Kirk alone who would make the ship unusual. Most of the flagship's complement and her entire command crew, save possibly whoever became her first officer, would be freshly graduated cadets. It certainly made a statement about the direction Starfleet intended to take, having survived Nero's blow. Did the Federation mean to make such a statement, or was it incidental? 3 months ago, Admiral Barnett had all but admitted that the Academy teaching staff had its collective hands full just trying to keep Kirk challenged. Around the same time, Kirk had volunteered to be used like a cheap whore by whatever department had need of him. 3 months later, Kirk had either charmed or worked his way into such good graces that Starfleet was giving him command of their most coveted ship, skipping over an uncounted number of better qualified captains who had proven themselves through years of service. Kirk must have done something then to make a better case for his promotion than all those others. But what? Admiral Barnett had seemed convinced that Kirk's assignment would make sense if Spock observed him. Walk his path, he'd said. Well, all right then. It was, of course, more difficult than Spock expected it to be. A search of the housing assignment database listed Kirk's apartment as one that clearly had not been inhabited for an extended period of time. Queries made to residents suggested Kirk had never lived there. So Spock began to search for Kirk's friends, assuming they would possess the cadet's address. Unfortunately, the only friend of Jim Kirk that Spock knew of was one Leonard McCoy, who had been nearly hostile to the Vulcan since Kirk's regrettable experience on Delta Vega. Apparently, Dr. McCoy understood the necessity of marooning a mutinying crew member only to the point of his closest friend nearly being eaten by local wildlife. At or after that, his understanding turned into what humans called a grudge. He was quite skilled at maintaining this grudge and tended to snarl whenever he came into contact with certain half-Vulcans. This tendency was not the sort that diminished with time. "What do you want?" McCoy snarled when his door opened to reveal Spock. The doctor was bleary-eyed and rumpled, as though he'd been sleeping or only recently woken. "I wish to ascertain the location of Cadet Kirk," Spock replied, hands behind his back as he resisted the urge to peer around McCoy's shoulder to see if Kirk was visiting. The doctor's lip curled. "What, you want to bring him up before the Admiralty personally this time? Spare him the effort of calling you out?" One of Spock's eyebrows quirked. "I withdrew my charge of academic dishonesty before the Enterprise returned to Earth, Dr. McCoy. As I left the planet shortly thereafter, and have only this day returned, I find it highly unlikely that Cadet Kirk could have done anything to merit such action on my part. Furthermore, as I have already stated, I am here to locate him, and logically cannot have been previously..." "All right," McCoy interrupted, scowling in the doorway without any indication that he would either step out or allow Spock entrance. It was a breach of social custom Spock accredited to the grudge. "Then why do you want to see him?" "Admiral Barnett requested it." "Yeah?" The doctor eyed him warily. "Why?" "I, unlike some others, do not make it a habit to interrogate superior officers." For a moment, Spock thought McCoy would attempt to do him physical harm. He released his obvious fury with the barked, "Fine!" instead, ducking back into his apartment to snatch a pad off a long, narrow table in the entryway. He scrolled through the data quickly, scowling. "What time is it?" he demanded without looking up. 0927. McCoy shut his eyes for a moment, shaking his head slightly. "Vulcans can't round up and just say 9:30? "Vulcans prize accuracy above simplicity, Doctor." "Sure they do." The doctor sighed deeply, shaking his head again as he scanned the pad. "We'll placate the human and say it's 9:30. If Jim's keeping his schedule, and wouldn't my life be easier if he ever did, he's got the programming seminar right now, but it's over soon, and there's a gap afterwards until 2. That's 1,400 hours for you, and good luck finding him if he gets away after the seminar. My responsibilities," he added with a snarl, "don't start for another 6 hours, since I was up until dawn doing rounds and recovery. So if you'll excuse me, Commander, I'm going back to bed." He stabbed an accusatory finger at Spock's face. "Do your job and go away. That kid has enough on his plate without you adding your crap to it. You leave him alone, you hear me?" Before Spock could respond, the door slid shut. All in all, a successful encounter. Then the Kirk factor crept into his expectations, because the cadet was not at all where McCoy had predicted he would be. The programming seminar was just letting out when Spock arrived, but Kirk was not among its chattering throng of students. Eventually, he stopped a pair of passing cadets to ask about the man's absence, and the looks he got could only be described as baffled. The girls glanced at each other, then Spock, then back at each other, as confused as if Spock had asked them the particulars of warp core mechanics. "Well, sir," one offered hesitantly, "Mr. Kirk's pretty busy. He's usually the first to leave, so you've got to come a little early if you want to catch him. I mean, he doesn't even hang around to answer questions." "To ask questions," Spock corrected her absently, already planning the best method of locating the cadet. "No, sir," the second girl corrected, shy but firm. "To answer questions." Spock's attention turned to her fully for the first time. Large gray eyes behind even larger glasses, she was pretty, but did not strike the Vulcan as someone with whom a man like Kirk would likely dally. "It would be the responsibility of your instructor to answer any questions you might have," he explained as simply as he could. Both girls scowled, though he wasn't sure why. "If Cadet Kirk has been taking advantage of..." "No!" they both snapped. An exchanged glance of embarrassed humor allowed their emotions to settle. Then the first, slightly taller and without glasses to hide her brown eyes, said again, "No, sir," she added hastily. "Mr. Kirk wouldn't ever take advantage of his students in any capacity." Both Spock's eyebrows shot toward his hairline. "His students," the second girl emphasized. "We're the junior class, sir. Our instructor was killed during that big mess a few months back. Mr. Kirk started as an interim instructor until someone else could be found, but he ended up being so good at it that the academy didn't bother. Our class test scores have been up an average of 6%, the first said defensively. "So if you're here to suggest he isn't doing his job..." "He is still a cadet," Spock pointed out. "Teaching an upper division elective seminar reserved for students with a programming specialty is not, in fact, his job." The girls scowled again, shifting their books and assorted pads in a jumble of motion that was more frustrated than it was necessary. "It is his job," the first insisted. "We've all had to step into roles not meant for us. I've been programming alongside senior analysts for nearly 2 weeks now. That shouldn't technically be my job either, but as a surviving Starfleet cadet, it is, and it will be, until our numbers can support our efforts again. So excuse me for arguing with you, Commander, but it is his job, and he's doing it brilliantly." "Come on, Hannah," the second girl urged, tugging her friend's elbow. "We'll never figure out Mr. Kirk's assignment if we don't start working on it now." "Yeah," Hannah agreed, turning her back on Spock with deliberate intent. "Let's get out of here, Jackie." Well, not quite as successful an encounter, but productive nonetheless. Kirk had developed responsibilities to, and supporters in, the junior class over the last 3 months, which Spock had not expected. Ah, that Kirk factor again. There was a definite pattern emerging. Spock spent the next several hours combing through the academy for anyone who knew where Kirk was. Most of his encounters resulted in people who knew where the cadet had been, but not where he would be. "Kirk? Oh yeah, he was here. He instructs most of the entry-level combat tactics courses. Kind of a think-or-sink situation with him, but he left like 15 minutes ago." "You just missed him. He usually volunteers to assist with the flight simulations for another hour or so, but I guess he's busy with something else today. You know that one. Always go, go, go." His study group just let out. "The man's a walking library, I swear. If you'd been here a minute ago..." "Oh, no, he had to skip this week's meeting. Chess can't be a priority in these times, after all." "No, man, he doesn't attend this class anymore. Are you nuts?" "Sir, he and the division chair have lunch once or twice a week in the cafeteria. He explodes her brain with all the stuff he knows that no one ever expected him to, and she clears him to volunteer in engineering. It's been a tradition for months. We all eavesdrop, because sometimes he can trick her into telling what's on the next test. You've never seen so many engineering students in the CAF for Vegan Day. It should have been frustrating. Somewhat contrarily, Spock was fascinated. Every fruitless conversation left him feeling as though he'd been given another clue, and by lunchtime his metaphoric hands were filled with the unexpected trove of a dozen interactions. After one last inquiry, a young man who flushed brightly and stammered, "Mr. Kirk? Oh, I don't really talk to him. He's Kirk, you know? But it's awesome when he fills in for my database reconstruction class. Those are the best days." Spock abandoned the chase and took his lunch in the quiet desert garden that remained a haven to him. Who would have expected such growth in only 3 months? Who could believe it? Was this well-respected pillar of Starfleet Academy really the same man who had once mocked and desecrated one of its simulations? Had this Kirk been in that angry cadet the entire time? And if so, which Kirk was the truest representation of who he would become? How had such a puzzle existed for so long without Spock noticing it? "Commander Spock, when did you get back?" Something in Spock almost wanted to smile, because here was that Kirk factor again. "Cadet Kirk," he greeted placidly, as the object of his search wound his way along the delicate garden path to stand grinning before him with that enormous satchel slung across his shoulders. "I returned only today." "It's good to see you," the cadet observed, taking in the Vulcan's health with a brief glance. "Did you find what you were looking for?" "Indeed. Of the several sites surveyed, two would be appropriate, though one is preferable to the other." Spock collected Kirk's physical self as another clue for later deconstruction. His wounds from the Nero mission were healed, though the way the fabric of his Academy shirt rested over his left elbow suggested a layer of bandages. Interesting. Other than that, the cadet appeared as bright and bold as ever, eyes wide and blue and clear. If Starfleet had to have a face to give the media, they could have done much worse than James Kirk. "What makes it preferable?" Kirk asked, stuffing his hands in his pockets. Spock glanced away from him. "The planet's surface temperature and humidity are nearly a 93% match to what Vulcans were." "Oh. So why don't you all just settle there, then?" "That is classified," the Vulcan admitted carefully. "But it is an issue with which the Admiralty is well equipped to deal." Kirk grinned again. "Man, the way you talk is amazing." When Spock's bearing became a degree colder, Kirk laughed. "No, it's a compliment. I've been learning a lot about Vulcans lately, so I'll probably give a warning before I start messing with you." "Indeed." "So," Kirk clapped his hands once, rubbing them together in an excited fashion. "Enough with these pleasantries. What's up? The gossip mill's working overtime today," he clarified when Spock ticked an eyebrow. "Apparently you've been looking for me?" Spock's expression blanked even more than usual before his dark eyes dropped to the last remnants of his afternoon meal. "Yes," he confirmed at length. "Admiral Barnett asked that I find you."
"Oh?"
Kirk appeared to puzzle through a mental list of why exactly Barnett would want that. "I'm stumped," he decided. "Barnett doesn't usually like talking to me if he can avoid it. I think I give him headaches or heartburn or something. Bones says I'll kill him eventually, but I'm betting I'll grow on him before that." "The Admiral did not send me after you for his sake," the Vulcan said, lifting his eyes again. "He sent me after you for my own sake, in order to reacquaint myself with the daily activities of the Academy, which he professed to be greatly altered since my absence. He suggested I observe your routine." Kirk visibly startled. "He what?" "I expressed a similar disbelief," Spock admitted. "Why do you do that?" "I could not reasonably attempt an answer. His methods are quite illogical." For some reason, that made Kirk grin again. "Well, whatever. Here we are, then." He crossed his arms, looking thoughtful. "So do you want me to make something up for Barnett when he asks? or are you actually okay with tagging along?" Spock hesitated. "While I am unclear as to what or why we would be tagging..." He paused to let Kirk laugh. "I would not be opposed to following Barnett's order, providing, of course, I will not be in the way." "Course not," Kirk agreed pleasantly. "It'd probably be better to start fresh tomorrow, but my schedule's pretty crazy of a Wednesday, so be warned." "Mr. Kirk!" Kirk lifted his eyes skyward for a moment before turning a grin on the trio of first-year cadets who trampled the garden to reach him. "Hey, respect the foliage, kids!" The three looked sheepish for a moment before remembering themselves. "Mr. Kirk," the only boy began in a pleading tone, "we've been working on that engineering problem Mr. Scott gave us all day, and we're completely stuck. He won't teach us to swear in Gaelic if we don't figure this out by dinner. Can you help us?" "Here's a bribe," one of the girls added, holding out a large cup of coffee. "Let me finish with Commander Spock, and I'll see what I can do," Kirk said, accepting the coffee with a grin. He drew a deep, appreciative lungful of the heady aroma. "But Scotty's a lot smarter than I am," he warned the cadets, "so no promises." "Scotty?" The cadets grinned to each other, trading covert hand gestures of success when Kirk turned his back on them. Ah, apparently Kirk had made more of an impression on the lower years than previously anticipated. "I have assorted nonsense to cater to for the rest of the day," Kirk said with a motion to the giggling trio, "so I've got to head out. How about we meet here tomorrow at 0700? The cadets stilled, looking between Kirk and Spock with wide eyes. Kirk rounded on them immediately. "None of that," he ordered. "You leave Commander Spock alone, all right? He never did anything to the rumor mill to deserve that kind of gossip. Okay?" The cadets visibly struggled to contain themselves. "Yes, sir," they managed at last. Kirk looked skeptical, but nodded. "So," he repeated to Spock, "0700? "Agreed," the Vulcan replied immediately. It was only after Kirk and his entourage had gone that Spock began to wonder if "crazy of a Wednesday" might not be a poor way to start his observations. It was even later when he considered that perhaps he was not the only one who possessed curious speech patterns. Discovering Atlas, Part 2. When Spock arrived at the garden at exactly 0700, Kirk was already waiting for him, the sling bag across his shoulders, a cup of steaming coffee in one hand and a pad in the other. He manipulated the touchscreen using his thumb for a few seconds before noticing Spock's presence, at which point he looked up with a large grin. "Good morning," the cadet greeted, shoving the pad into a side pocket of the bulging satchel. "Ready to get started?" "Indeed," Spock agreed placidly, hands resting at the small of his back. "What is the first order of business?" "Well, see," Kirk admitted, motioning vaguely with his coffee, "that's why Wednesdays are so crazy. I've only got 2 standing appointments, and they're hours apart." "May I inquire after the nature of these appointments?" "Admiral Archer takes a block of my morning." Kirk pulled out a different pad from the zippered pocket that ran the length of the bag's back, scrolling through a few pages before handing it to Spock. "It's kind of a brunch time frame, from 10:00 to 11:45. What I do then isn't..." He motioned again with his free hand this time, as though to pull the appropriate phrase from thin air. "The appointment isn't exactly essential to Starfleet's operation. So if you have somewhere else to be around then, I completely understand. In fact, I encourage it." Spock studied Kirk for a quiet moment before glancing down at the pad. It was the day's schedule, huge blocks of empty space broken by a section marked Archer, and another at the end of the day, 2100 to 2300, designated Crew. "To what does the second appointment refer?" he asked, relinquishing the pad. His hands gravitated to their usual resting place as he catalogued vague embarrassment on the cadet's face. "That's... Not exactly Academy business either, he hedged. Spock waited him out. All right, Kirk sighed after only a small handful of seconds. So every Wednesday, a bunch of the cadets who served on the Nero mission get together and try to drink Scotty under the table. We can't, by the way. You attend this meeting every Wednesday? The Vulcan wondered, trying to understand Kirk's logic. Did he know all those cadets had requested to serve with him? Was it an attempt to ingratiate himself? When I can, Kirk agreed. Apparently, Chekov pouts when I have to miss, and Uhura bugs me about it for days afterwards because he's got a really effective pout, so it's easier in the long run to just be there and avoid the fallout. Faced with a statement like that, Spock hardly knew where to begin. Pouting Russian geniuses and Uhura willingly and routinely sharing a meal with Kirk? If I may, he attempted at last. Just then, the distinctive buzz of a communicator wailed from Kirk's bag. The cadet stuffed his pad back in its pocket, rummaging for the source of the noise. Kirk here, he called, flipping the unit open. Mr. Kirk, an older female voice crowed in a chipper British accent. Prompt as usual. Kirk grinned. I do my best, Commander Pearson. Quite right. Listen, spot a bother here on the AV labs with a new program we got from one of those trial basis civilian contracts. Wondered if you couldn't pop by for a tick, have a quick peek at the code before our communications cadet take a crack at it. I know it isn't your specialization, but you've been such a help lately, I thought I might at least ask. I'll head over there right now, the cadet promised. Good man. Pearson out, then. So it begins, Kirk laughed with a grin for Spock. It took him less than an hour to locate and correct the coding error leading to Commander Pearson's program malfunction, during which time Kirk received and scheduled an additional 3 service calls. The engine's making kind of a put, put, put when it should go just like rrrr. I called the engineering department, but you know how backed up they get these days. Do you have a minute? Since the tech aides are booked solid for the next 3 lifetimes, we try to troubleshoot it ourselves. Now there's just this blue screen. Do you have some time later? Then the whole unit burst into flame. I don't suppose you could give it a once-over. And that, Kirk said succinctly as he ended the most recent comm for help, is why Wednesdays are crazy. Have the actual repair and service departments collapsed in my absence? Spock wondered as they made their way toward the simulations hangar. What sounded like a cascade failure in the cooling systems had caused the inoperability of several entry-level simulations the freshman class needed to prepare for exams. Instructors and students alike were panic-stricken as finals loomed close. Most of the really good techs have been reassigned to starships until cadets can be graduated into their positions, Kirk explained, filling in another slot in his previously loose schedule. This Wednesday thing is my own fault, anyway. In what capacity? Kirk grinned at the phrasing. Well, right before you left, when personnel was kind of thin on the ground, a bunch of us started to just fix things when they went haywire instead of putting in work orders. We're all regretting that now, of course, since it snowballed into shit like Wednesday. He shrugged a little sheepishly. The Academy's gotten shameless about squeezing every last drop out of anyone stupid enough to volunteer services. It's kind of horrifying and amazing at the same time. I mean, damn. Talk about utilizing resources. He nudged his elbow into Spock's as they walked, grinning when the Vulcan glanced at him. I wouldn't be surprised if even you got sucked into the cross-departmental helping game before long, you poor, unsuspecting, untapped resource. Before Spock could do more than quirk an eyebrow, the communicator chirped again. Kirk rolled his eyes and answered with a brief, Kirk here. Kirk, my boy, I've heard you got an extra shadow today. The cadet smirked at Spock. Told you so. I do, sir. Commander Spock is with me by Admiral Barnett's order. Very good. I don't suppose you would loan him to the senior chemistry lab. Temporarily, of course. One of the instructors is running late today, and we could use a proctor for her exams. I wouldn't normally bother Commander Spock, but our division's a bit run down with the flu today. It's just for a moment, an hour at the most. Kirk looked questioningly at Spock, who inclined his head a degree in agreement. I wouldn't exactly call it loaning, the cadet relayed, but Commander Spock is on his way now. Wonderful! We'll return him in perfect working order before you even notice he's gone. We won't even need to mention it to Admiral Barnett. Hmm? Very good. Stevens out. I guess time's up for now, Kirk observed, shifting his bag. Good luck escaping the chem lab. I'm quite familiar with the specific requirements of proctoring a fellow instructor's exam, Spock said mildly. My presence should not be required beyond the time frame of a single class period, at which point I will endeavor to continue my observations of your Wednesday. Unless, he qualified with a slightly challenging glance, you have nothing further to show me? Oh, no, Kirk laughed. Wednesdays get much worse than this. Then after my appointment, Spock promised, I shall find you. Feel free to try. The cadet glanced at his watch. If you get loose anywhere between 10:00 and 11:45, which, by the way, I wouldn't put money on, I'll be at Admiral Archer's residence. For the appointment that is not essential to Starfleet's operation, the Vulcan recalled. Yeah, Kirk sighed, and let me say right now how absolutely thrilled I am that you, of all people, might bear witness to it. He shook his head to dismiss the topic. Anyway, Archer's place is your best bet for catching me. If we miss each other after that, well... He arched an ironic brow, lifting his busy communications unit to wiggle it slightly. You could always calm me. I doubt very much I will be required to resort to such measures, Spock observed, but I will nevertheless bear it in mind. Kirk opened his mouth to respond, rolling his eyes skyward instead when his comm unit chirped again. Later, he reiterated, grinning at Spock one last time. He flicked the buzzing device open with practiced ease as he jogged away. Kirk here. At barely 8:30 in the morning, with the majority of the campus only now rousing for the day, crazy of a Wednesday seemed an unusually prolific sort of understatement. Admiral Archer's residence sat on a plot of land reserved for high-ranking Starfleet officials. The house itself was rather smaller than many of the other nearby accommodations, resulting in more undisturbed land. As most of Starfleet knew, Archer used the additional free acres to breed dogs. He'd gone so far as to build an entire kennel in his backyard for the sole purpose of whelping beagles, which Spock knew intellectually, but could not understand. Another thing Spock did not understand was why exactly Cadet Kirk spent 1¾ hours with Admiral Archer on a day as busy as his Wednesday appeared to be. Especially since Kirk himself admitted the appointment was non-essential to Starfleet operations. What could possibly excuse it? The answer was puppies. At 11:20, Spock found Kirk in the yard behind Archer's kennel, surrounded by 6 young, wriggling beagles, all vying for his attention. He stuck his hand in a pocket, producing a selection of treats he used to coerce the pups into a series of commands that they obeyed readily, if sloppily. Not what you were expecting, I'll bet. Spock turned to discover Admiral Archer standing at his side, eyes on Kirk and the young dogs. Owing to a lack of established situational parameters, the Vulcan corrected blankly, I had no expectations upon my arrival, sir. Still, the Admiral insisted, smiling faintly as one of the dogs squirmed onto its back by Kirk's leg, demanding a belly rub. When he knelt to comply, the others rushed him in a tumble of ecstatic yelps. Puppies. Indeed. For a long moment they watched in silence as Kirk regained control of the beagles through a masterful blend of firm commands and the offering of treats. He's repaying a favor, Archer explained at last. Spock glanced at him, but didn't reply. The Admiral never took his eyes from his dogs. The engineer Kirk picked up on Delta Vega was there because I put him there. Scott lost me my prize dog. Archer's mouth ticked in annoyance. I'd have let that Scottish bastard freeze until doomsday if Kirk didn't want him so badly. Don't think of it as losing a beagle, he tells me. Archer shook his head in exasperation as he recalled the memory. Think of it as Starfleet gaining a Scotty. Ballsy son of a bitch. It's a wonder to me no one's killed him yet. I don't even like terriers, he added to Spock with something like indignation. What did any of this have to do with James Kirk training beagle puppies? Archer sighed, shaking his head again. Kirk's got some kind of background in dogs, and I don't have the time lately to properly train the litter, so he suggested a trade. He'd train them to consistently obey basic commands, and I'd clear Scott for duty as chief engineer on the Enterprise. It's a good trade, he admitted, if not quite as satisfying as the thought of Scott on Delta Vega. After a few beats of silence, Spock settled his hands at the small of his back. If I may make an observation, sir, he requested mildly. Archer inclined his head. Regardless of any personal arrangements made between you and the cadet, the potential negative impact of this situation upon Starfleet likely outweighs any perceived benefits. The Academy has demonstrated a need for Cadet Kirk's skills that precludes his use as a dog trainer. Furthermore, Mr. Scott's own aptitude for engineering is much better utilized here than on Delta Vega, which logically demands his release from any punitive detail he may have previously been serving. Archer faced Spock, his expression reflecting mild annoyance. You've missed the point. Surprised, the Vulcan met Archer's gaze. Sir, I assure you that my observations in this matter are based upon the facts as you presented them, and are therefore quite logical. Spock, I cleared Scott for duty aboard the Enterprise the day Kirk requested it. Then it would appear, as you said. I have indeed missed the point, Spock replied. Perhaps you might enlighten me. Why is Cadet Kirk training canines when the Academy has need of him? Archer turned back to Kirk. The problem with that boy, he said in a low voice, is that he's something of a rare breed these days. He's very good at a lot of things we desperately need people to be good at right now. We're demanding more of him than any of his contemporaries, which isn't fair to him. And we know that, the same way we know that we can't afford to stop doing it. We also know that even though he's besting every challenge we throw at him, he's going to collapse if he doesn't get some space to breathe. The stubborn cuss just never schedules any. So when his psychotic doctor friend started complaining to the Admiralty about Kirk's workload, we took matters into our own hands. Archer glanced sidelong at Spock to see if the Vulcan could connect the dots on his own. It wasn't strictly a logical solution, so the Admiral wasn't quite surprised by Spock's continued lack of understanding. I make Kirk come here, Archer explained succinctly, because dogs are therapeutic and calming. He has twice weekly advisory meetings with Pike for nearly the same reason. A person has to vent somehow. If pups and Pike are what it takes to keep that boy functioning at full strength, well, I don't mind his being here. I see. Though clearly Spock didn't. Not quite. Is the cadet aware of your underlying intentions? Or those of Admiral Pike? Archer shrugged. Who knows? If he does, he hasn't said as much. Although I'd bet not. He hasn't protested coming here or seeing Pike, and if he ever got it into his head that we were wasting his time with useless meetings, you can be sure he'd make noise about it. I see, the Vulcan murmured, eyes trained on Kirk. This time, Archer thought, he just might. Later, when the appointment was over and Spock walked with Kirk to the cadet's next distress call, the Vulcan had to restrain himself from a litany of questions regarding Kirk's interpretation of the situation with Archer. Kirk seemed aware of Spock's self-imposed reticence, but couldn't appear to decide whether he wanted to break the silence or let it stand. His struggle, somewhat predictably, didn't last long. All right, he sighed, adjusting the strap of his heavy bag. I can hardly stand your suspense. What do you want to know? which was all the permission Spock required. How did Admiral Archer come to know you had, as he put it, a background in dogs? The cadet hitched one shoulder in a careless shrug. My first year, one of his dogs escaped. Malcolm, he specified with a curious half-smile, his prized beagle. I found him and ended up keeping him a whole weekend before seeing the missing dog announcements. He learned some new tricks while I had him, and I guess it stuck with Archer. He let me visit the dogs starting then, but I only got a hand in training them over the past few months. Breeders tend to be finicky about stuff like that. Where did you acquire your proficiency at canine obedience programming? Kirk glanced away, mouth drawn into a thin, unhappy line. It's something I picked up when I was younger. Spock considered that response, turning it over thoughtfully. From a breeder local to your place of birth? He asked for clarification. No. Kirk's shoulders tensed as he seemed to draw in on himself. There weren't any breeders in my hometown, and I wasn't born there. I just picked it up around. Anything else you want to know? He added in an obvious attempt to redirect the conversation. Fascinating. Why would the cadet find such a mundane topic discomforting? Spock studied him through a covert sidelong glance for a long moment before replying. Is Mr. Scott aware that you procured his freedom from exile by agreeing to train a litter of beagles? Kirk shuddered. No, he said immediately, glancing around to see if anyone on the commons had overheard. Spock's eyebrows migrated toward his hairline. And you aren't going to tell him either. What would be the logic behind withholding the information from Mr. Scott? Human emotional bonds are often strengthened by such examples of devotion. I'd never live it down, that's why. He motioned firmly with one hand, cutting through the sharing is caring idea with a decisive swipe. Scotty and I can bond over something else, like booze. That seems to be working so far. Spock cataloged the cadet's expressions for later study as he moved across the campus at an increasingly brisk pace. You are quite emphatic about this. Kirk frowned thoughtfully at the sidewalk, wondering which tactic would be most effective in making the Vulcan keep Archer's dogs under wraps. Obedience training isn't exactly in keeping with the notorious badass angle I'm working here. In fact, he added with a winning smile as the perfect argument presented itself, such conflicting reports regarding my behavioral patterns would probably just confuse people, and there's so much of that going on around me naturally that it'd be positively illogical to toss baby beagle training into the mix, too. So let's just never speak of it again. Spock lifted one eyebrow, leveling a doubtful sidelong glance at the cadet. Kirk stubbornly maintained his charming smile. They might have continued on that way indefinitely had a small gaggle of second-year cadets not noticed them and called, Mr. Kirk! With obvious relief. Ha! Kirk crowed, grinning at Spock as though he'd won something. Then he turned his dazzling expression on the cadets, who faltered to a man under the undivided attention of those blue eyes. Hey, kids, what's up? The ringleader glanced at his friends, obviously struggling to remember his initial problem. He blinked with a thoughtful frown, then started in recollection. Oh, yeah! His expression turned pleading and desperate. We have a theories of command structure final on Friday, and the last three chapters of the text might as well be written in Greek. Can you help us? We'll buy you lunch, one of his friends added frantically. Kirk turned to Spock, who was distracted by an incoming distress call from the science department. Welcome to Wednesday, the cadet said with a grin when Spock glanced up. Now that they know you'll respond, they'll probably keep you hopping. Tell you what, he offered, shifting the weight of his bag from one shoulder to the other. Why don't I comm you the location of tonight's dinner? You were a part of the crew, after all. That way you can catch up with Uhura and everyone, and I don't have to feel like I'm dragging you all over campus for no reason. Spock visibly hesitated. It would be nice to speak with Uhura again, especially under relaxed conditions. But Dr. McCoy had also been part of the crew. Think about it, Kirk prompted, clapping a hand against Spock's shoulder in farewell. Come on, kiddies, he continued to the cadets, corralling them toward the nearest eatery. Let's go work out the best way to cheat the hell out of that final. Though the younger cadets all snickered, Spock was shocked by the statement. Surely Kirk wouldn't discuss such a matter in front of one who had in recent memory triggered a formal investigation into his academic conduct. Kirk glanced back at Spock only once, registering his vague alarm with a triumphant laugh. Spock realized he was being, as humans might say, messed with. So much for Kirk's promise of a warning. After parting ways with Kirk, Spock's day descended into madness, the likes of which he had never experienced. His presence, once established as fact, was demanded by a vast majority of the Academy's departments almost simultaneously. When Kirk's formal invitation to dinner arrived, Spock began to use it as a kind of shield to save him from further hours of endless multitasking. My presence is required elsewhere during that time period. Apologies. I must decline your request to assist in fungi cultivation. I have a previous engagement. A long-standing invitation prevents me from tutoring your entire class on the finer points of basic mathematics, but perhaps you might turn your attention to the textbook that has been in your possession for the entirety of your tenure at this academy. Due in whole to that Kirk factor, the dinner was neither where nor what Spock had expected. The directions led him to a hangar deep in the heart of the engineering department's territory. Inside, graduating cadets and a smaller selection of regular Starfleet officers were clustered around several metallic picnic tables, food and drink spread in pockets where the population density was greatest. The once crew of the Enterprise had broken itself along division lines, though several individuals floated group to group with haphazard ease. One of these individuals was, of course, James Kirk. Even as Spock watched, Kirk wandered from a table made of security personnel to sit between Chekhov and Sulu at a table that was heavily laden with large sheets of paper. He bent his head to listen to Chekhov, nodding periodically as his bearing became gradually more excited. When Chekhov fell silent, Kirk grinned broadly at Sulu, who matched his expression exactly. Then they all three leaned over the paper spread across the table, plotting in eager whispers. It was not an entirely settling scene. Dr. McCoy, who was sitting with Uhura at an otherwise empty table, seemed to reach a similar conclusion. His eyes narrowed as he studied Kirk, and he set down his bottled drink with something alarmingly like malicious intent. Uhura glanced between McCoy and the trio of unsuspecting conspirators for a moment before covering her mouth with a single slender hand. If she thought it would hide her amusement, she was badly misinformed. McCoy, standing in a single irritated motion, either didn't see her or chose to ignore the enjoyment she was clearly deriving from the situation. He strode over to Kirk, looming behind him with both hands planted on his hips, fury dark on his face. Spock stepped to Uhura's side, nodding once to acknowledge her smiled greeting. When her smile melted into a smirk, they both turned their attention to the predicament building one table over behind Kirk's back. "This is going to be great," Uhura murmured to him low enough that only Vulcan ears would catch it. Sulu and Chekhov have been able to avoid getting on McCoy's bad side so far, but it was really only a matter of time. Spock lifted an eyebrow and waited. After a minute of eavesdropping, McCoy's expression had gone thunderous. It was Sulu who noticed him, pulling out of his intense discussion with Kirk and Chekhov mid-word. His slack-jawed horror alerted the others, who turned immediately to locate the source. Kirk only shut his eyes on a long sigh, but Chekhov threw his torso over the papers, using his crossed arms as an additional barrier, his eyes wide and panicked in a pale face. For a moment, no one moved. Then Kirk laughed brightly, giving Chekhov's shoulder a fond shake. "Next week," he said, "we work on subtlety, okay? Relax. When we're in real trouble, you'll know it." Chekhov didn't look convinced, but he moved willingly enough when McCoy shoved him off the papers. "Oh, no," the doctor insisted as he studied whatever scheme now lay bare before him. He jammed a forefinger into Kirk's shoulder. "No, Jim, I don't know what you're planning, but no." Kirk grinned winningly at Chekhov. "And see, here's today's final lesson. Take notes," he suggested, "because this is what real trouble looks like." "You don't get to have cohorts," McCoy snarled, ignoring Kirk's aside completely. Chekhov, meanwhile, was obediently taking notes while Sulu attempted to covertly roll up the evidence of their plan. McCoy swatted his hands away with a scowl, turning his head slightly to better inspect the document. "Why do you have maps of... where is this? Is this topographical?" he demanded of Kirk. "Are you dabbling in topography now?" Kirk made a dismissive motion. "Don't be silly, Bones. I have no interest in boring old topography." "Oh." McCoy looked suspicious but relieved. "Good, because I can't take..." "This is ocean topography," the blue-eyed cadet clarified, sweeping an arm over the whole mess in illustration. "And Chekhov looked it up when he was running weather reports. That's these printouts here, in case you were wondering." "God damn it, Jim!" "But it's such a great idea," Kirk insisted, swinging one leg over the bench so he could spread his hands imploringly. "And Sulu's really excited about it, aren't you, Sulu?" Sulu grinned. It did nothing to assuage the doctor's ire. "Not to mention all the research Chekhov's done. We couldn't just waste all that effort, could we?" "This man is a walking disaster," McCoy informed the other two cadets in furious accusation. "He nearly got himself killed crossing the commons in fair weather, armed with nothing but a cup of coffee, while surrounded by med students. A flea vaccine could do the job. He doesn't need your help." Sulu and Chekhov traded an uncomfortable glance, obviously reluctant to call the doctor's fury down upon themselves, but equally unwilling to abandon their plan. "You know, actually, doctor," Chekhov offered carefully, gathering up several printouts to offer them to Bones, "the research supports a fairly reasonable probability of success without injury." Bones stared at the teen in outraged accusation. "A two, Chekhov? You're enablers," he hissed threateningly, "and I won't have it." Kirk rose fluidly from his seat, wrapping an arm around his friend's shoulders to steer him away from his cringing enablers. "You're just sore because you didn't get an invite," he teased gently. McCoy allowed Kirk to tow him back toward his original table, but didn't relax so much as a single muscle. "Come on, Bones," Kirk cajoled softly, squeezing him once before releasing him with a comforting thump on the back. "It'll be fun." "It'll be dangerous." "You can bring your med bag," Kirk promised. He looked up, presumably with the intent of grinning at Uhura, but noticed Spock first. His expression lit in delight, blue eyes bright with a smile. "Spock," he greeted, pulling McCoy onto the bench next to him as he sat. Spock mirrored the action, taking his place by Uhura. "Good evening, Cadet Kirk." "It's Jim here," Kirk insisted, grin shifting over to Uhura, who rolled her eyes. But she was smiling too, and Spock wondered where her animosity had gone. Some of it, apparently, had migrated to McCoy, who scowled openly at Spock. "What's he doing here?" Kirk looked at Bones askance. "Well," he said slowly, "you see, a couple of months back, Spock was part of this ridiculously dangerous Federation-saving mission, wherein he served aboard the Enterprise with..." "I know that," McCoy growled. "But what's he doing here?" Kirk frowned, projecting a general air of confusion. "This is a crew reunion, Bones. Spock is crew. I don't see the problem." McCoy looked positively incredulous. "Yes, and I must thank you for the invitation, Jim," Spock added before anyone could comment further. McCoy's incredulity turned into shock with the Vulcan's casual form of address. Uhura had to turn away to disguise her laughter. On that topic, I would like to extend my gratitude that you would allow me to accompany you throughout your day. It was of great benefit to my understanding of the Academy's changes, though you experienced no similar advantage. Kirk brushed the sentiment off with an easy wave of his hand. Not everything has to be about benefit. Who knows, he grinned, leaning his forearms against the table. Maybe I just wanted someone to suffer through Wednesday with me. You are aware, of course, Spock observed after a moment, that the satisfied desire for companionship is in itself a benefit. Kirk laughed. See that right there? That's exactly what I'm talking about. You're a riot. McCoy frowned thoughtfully at his friend. Just how much did you have to drink before I got here? I'm surrounded by comedians, Jim remarked sagely to Uhura, who started to laugh again. He stood before anyone else could be antagonized. I'm going to get some food. Requests? He offered. When he was gone, Spock turned his attention to Uhura, ignoring the doctor as he muttered to himself crossly and rolled a cold bottle of beer between his hands. I had not anticipated your opinion of Cadet Kirk undergoing substantial change while I was away, he said, the real question lurking quietly in his observation. Uhura made a thoughtful sound, her gaze tracking slowly to where Kirk stood, arms loaded with food as he leaned over Scotty's shoulder, already deeply engaged in another schematics debate. He shifted his haul to point at a particular modification, hardly noticing when some of the food tumbled out of his hold. He isn't what I expected, she admitted abruptly. When we got back to Starfleet Command after the Nero incident, I thought he'd trade on his role as the Federation's savior. She rolled her eyes at the memory of 1,000 reporters from 12 worlds all clamoring for an exclusive. It wouldn't have exactly been difficult. No, Spock agreed mildly. Any of those who had served upon the Enterprise could have made a small fortune in personal appearances in the aftermath of Nero. Not one of them had. And then, just after you left, we all started to realize how much trouble the Academy was in. Uhura's expression washed with pain. Her eyes dropped from Kirk, settling on the dented tabletop beneath her fingertips. Most of our class died. A bunch of the student teachers and instructors, too. At first, no one really knew what to do, how to keep going with so much of the support structure gone, or how to just get from day to day. Then, she recalled, with a faint smile bowing her mouth, in one of the command classes, the projector broke. Instead of calling for someone else to fix it, Kirk stood on his desk and did it himself. And instead of waiting for a substitute instructor who didn't quite know the subject material, Kirk moved through the lecture notes and taught it on his own. So his classmates started to do the same kind of thing all over campus. Uhura shrugged, lacing her fingers together as she lifted eyes dark with pride to Spock's. It turned viral within a week. Every surviving senior cadet began standing up, stepping forward. I'm teaching most of the introductory xenolinguistics courses now. Admirable, Spock noted, looking over the senior cadets in the room. They were happy and boisterous as the cadets of his own class had been so close to graduation, but there was a gravity of sorts that lingered in their faces. They sat straighter, speaking to commissioned officers with the self-assurance that usually took years to develop. The results, no doubt, of Admiral Barnett's baptism by fire. Spock wondered with a deep sense of fascination what kind of officers these cadets would become. It hasn't been easy, Uhura concluded with a slight shrug, but it was simple in a way. There was a need, and it was one we could fill, so we did. I expected Kirk to start a rebellion when I realized how few instructors had survived. She laughed, shaking her head, and settled her eyes on the grinning profile of James Kirk. He started a revolution instead, and dragged us all in after him. Not like you didn't go willingly, McCoy snarked, pointing the mouth of his beer bottle toward her in a weary motion. Not like we all didn't. He shook his head, taking a long pull off the bottle. When he set it down, it was empty. Uhura tipped her head in acknowledgement. "So I wanted to know who this Kirk guy was," she added to Spock, referencing back to his original unspoken question. "That we would follow him so willing." "The more I found out, the more curious I became, and then he started these crew reunion dinners." "And what," Spock posed delicately, "are your observations?" McCoy scowled at him, but Uhura just made another thoughtful sound, cradling her chin in one delicate hand that she propped on the table. "Have you noticed anything odd about him? Particularly in the way he moves?" The doctor threw his hands in the air. "Oh, not this again." Uhura flushed lightly, rolling her eyes and spreading her hands in a helpless gesture. "Come on, McCoy, you can't honestly expect me to believe him. There has to be another explanation, a rational explanation." Spock's eyebrows lifted toward his hairline. "I presume we are speaking of Cadet Kirk?" "Jim," McCoy stressed. "If you're going to be here, you have to at least call him Jim." "Jim," Spock amended accordingly. He wondered why McCoy didn't make the same demand of Uhura, but didn't press the matter. "What explanation has Jim given that does not meet your standard of rationality?" "He speaks Russian," Uhura said, the words in accusation. "I overheard him talking to Chekhov about a month ago, and he's completely fluent." "Was he unwilling to relate the circumstances of his developing such a proficiency?" "That's the problem." Uhura spread her arms, expression incredulous. "He says he learned it in the circus." "There are circuses in Russia," McCoy pointed out, though he was smirking as he said it, making it seem like he was goading her more than anything else. Uhura wrinkled her nose. "James Kirk did not run away and join the Russian circus. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard." "What is Cadet Chekhov's opinion on the matter?" Spock asked politely. When they both stared at him, he lifted one eyebrow. "Surely a native Russian would be able to pinpoint the general region from which Cadet Kirk, Jim's instructor, hailed." "That doesn't help," Uhura sighed, swiping the beer McCoy dug out of the cooling unit by his feet. He scowled but fetched himself another. "I can break down the regional quirks myself. He's got bits and pieces of nearly everywhere he tosses in just when I think I've got it nailed. Frustrating." She took a long drink, making a soft sound of appreciation. "I'd ask Chekhov straight out where he thought Kirk picked it up, but it wouldn't help." "Is Cadet Chekhov untrustworthy?" Spock asked. Uhura laughed warmly. "No, he's a good kid, kind of a sweetheart. But he'd say the sky was green if Kirk told him to." "Jim would never ask Chekhov to lie for him," McCoy insisted, frowning at his beer. "How can you be sure of that?" Uhura wondered. McCoy smirked, tipping his bottle in a tiny salute. "Because Chekhov would say the sky was green if Jim told him to." "So we can't ask Chekhov," Uhura repeated, lifting her bottle in acknowledgement of McCoy's point. "Which is why I thought I'd see if you noticed anything, Spock. Because he wasn't part of a Russian circus." "He wasn't," she insisted when McCoy opened his mouth. "Let's ask him," the doctor suggested, smirking again. Uhura rolled her eyes. "He isn't going to say anything new, and what he usually says isn't convincing me." "Yeah," McCoy agreed, twisting in his seat to scan for his wayward friend. "But your face, when he's going off in Russian, is just..." He cut himself off with a long and impressive string of expletives. Uhura followed his gaze and winced. "Damn," she sighed. "Them again. Isn't he off duty for the night?" "With them?" McCoy snarled, such a genuine hatred on his face that Spock was almost startled. "He's never off duty." He shoved himself away from the table, stalking across the room. James Kirk stood by the farthest doorway of the hangar, his arms still filled with food, face blank as he read a pad given to him by a black-clothed courier. When he was finished, he nodded once, and the messenger snapped a quick salute before leaving. McCoy cornered Kirk moments later, arms crossed to contain his fury as he scowled. Jim shrugged somewhat helplessly. They returned to Spock and Uhura, McCoy radiating impotent rage while Kirk merely looked resigned. "Sorry, guys," he said, dumping his food and drink on the table. "Looks like I gotta go. Duty calls. Sulu," he added in a louder voice, "check up." When they glanced over, he grinned with a cocky expression. "Tomorrow, 0600? They returned the grin, more excited than anything else, and Chekov offered a thumbs up. Jim gripped McCoy's shoulder, giving it one firm shake. "Think positive, man. Sometimes I just sit around." McCoy scowled, shrugging off the comfort. "And sometimes you tear ligaments, or get concussions, or lose half your weight in blood." Kirk offered a cockeyed smile. "That's why you think positive." Before anyone else could retort, Jim was gone, jogging from the building with his expression hidden by shadows. The doctor swore again in several languages, some of which even Spock didn't recognize. Uhura winced twice. "He'll be okay," she murmured when McCoy wound down. The doctor glared at her for a beat. "He's gonna get himself killed," he snarled. "He just better not come crawling to me when it happens." Then he stood from the table in a jerky motion. "I'm going to get my kit ready." When he stomped away, the cloud of fury around him was so obvious that cadets tripped over each other getting out of his way. After a thoughtful pause, Spock regarded Uhura. "May I inquire after the nature of Jim's apparent predicament?" Uhura bit her lip, picking at the label on her beer. "He's helping out." She wrinkled her nose as though smelling something foul, filling a need. "We're not really sure with what, because it's so classified he can't even hint about it, but sometimes," she explained with a frustrated shrug, "when he comes back from helping them, he's injured. Not all of the time, but enough. Whoever or whatever they are, they're dangerous." "If the requests are known to be potentially detrimental to his health," Spock asked, "why does Jim not simply refuse them?" For a long moment, Uhura was silent, her face pinched with worry as she tore the label from its bottle. "Because at the beginning," she whispered, "he promised to help everyone who needed it, anyone who asked. And these people, they keep asking, so he won't refuse them." She looked up at Spock, shrugging with a painful expression. "He can't. Because he promised." Occasionally, that Kirk factor was quite a terrible phenomenon.